So tonight we're here because we love our Jesuits. Any people that were educated by a Jesuit at some point in the house? All right. Awesome. Quick intro. My name is Megan McClenahan. For those who don't know me or receive my weekly emails, from Jonathan and myself, we welcome you to Theology on Tap. We are so happy you're here tonight. We would love to help you connect with young adults in the area in any way that we can. So please, you know, tap me on the shoulder if there's anything we can do to help connect you more with the church here locally. We'd love to do that. We'd love it if you would follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And any comments or quotes you want to tag from tonight with the hashtag TOTDC, that would be fantastic as well. Without further ado, I wanted to introduce our speakers tonight, the hosts of Jesuitical, the podcast hosted through America Magazine. We are so incredibly blessed to have Olga, Zach, and Ashley here tonight. Olga and Zach are both Jesuit educated. Olga went to Fordham University. Zach went to Loyola Chicago, so Sister Jean fan. Awesome. And Ashley grew up across the Potomac in Arlington and graduated from the University of Virginia. Together, they host the Jesuitical podcast, which is produced by America Media. The podcast has been around for just over a year, and they drop a new episode most Fridays, and they're available for free wherever you get your podcasts. We're so excited to have them speak tonight about how to incorporate Jesuit spirituality into millennial life. So please help me welcome Jesuitical.
Hello. So I know it's my job to talk into a microphone, but we usually do it in a room by ourselves. So having a sea of people in front of us is a little bit different. But hello and welcome to Theology on Tap. I'm Ashley McKinless.
I'm Zach.
I am Olga Segura.
And we are the hosts of Jesuitical, a podcast for young and young at heart Catholics. We're all editors at America. It's a media ministry of the Society of Jesus. So I know we have some Jesuit alums in here, but for those who aren't familiar, America Magazine has been published by the Jesuits since 1909. And today we produce videos, a radio show, events, and of course, a podcast. And so if you are not familiar with the Jesuits, we've got Georgetown University in D.C., and then 28 colleges and universities in the U.S. We also have some celebrity Jesuits that we want to shout out to. Maybe you've read a book by our colleague, Father James Martin.
I thought you were going to mention me. I'm sorry.
Father Jim is a Jesuit priest, the former chaplain of the Colbert Report, and the author of The Jesuit Guide to Almost Everything. And perhaps the most famous member of the society, though don't tell this to Father Martin, is Pope Francis, who, if you didn't know, became our first ever Jesuit Pope 5 years ago. And if you have not heard of Jesuitical, the podcast, perhaps you've heard the term Jesuitical used to insult someone. someone who maybe seemed to be making an argument that was a bit too clever or not entirely sincere. But Zach, Olga, and I are working to rehabilitate the term Jesuitical. For us and our colleagues at America, Jesuitical means bringing the gospel message to the streets, to magazines, to podcast feeds, and yes, to bars, and anywhere else that the issues of the day are being debated in charity and love. This is exactly what St. Ignatius, the founder of the Society of Jesus, wanted. His great innovation when he started his religious order back in 1534 was moving religious life from the countryside to the public square. Before Ignatius, being a contemplative meant living in a monastery, set apart from the affairs and the messiness of city life. Ignatius and the Jesuits, who have followed in his path, sought to be contemplatives in action. So today, you will meet Jesuits who are teachers, who are actors, who are astrophysicists, social workers, and any other job you can think of. Which is why we think Jesuit spirituality, also known as Ignatian spirituality, is a really great model of Christian life for those of us who live busy lives in places like Washington, D.C. and New York. Few of us have the luxury of long stretches of uninterrupted silence or access to regular community prayer. Ignatian spirituality provides a way of praying and operating in the world that you can carry with you on the metro or subway or at the office and into your relationships. So, what does living out Ignatian spirituality as a millennial look like today? We thought we would talk about this by looking at it through the lens of the three segments of our podcast. So first, I'm going to cover Signs of the Times, the part of our show where we talk about the Catholic news of the week. Next, the interview segment, which Olga will speak on, where we talk with a guest who offers a unique perspective on world events, culture, and our faith. And finally, Consolations and Desolations, the part of our show where we talk about where we found God in our own lives or where it was harder to find God, Zach will speak about later. But first, Signs of the Times. The phrase actually cannot be claimed by the Jesuits. It comes from the Second Vatican Council. In a document called Gaudium et Spes, the Council Fathers wrote, quote, "The Church has always had the duty of scrutinizing the signs of the times and of interpreting them in light of the gospel. We must, therefore, recognize and understand the world in which we live, its explanations, its longings, and its often dramatic characteristics," end quote. In other words, we need to read the news. Catholics are not meant to wall themselves off from the world, but rather to look outward. That means paying attention to current events in our own country and around the world. In doing so, in the age of Twitter and Facebook and constant push notifications on our smartphones, can be overwhelming and frankly disheartening. So for even avid political junkies, reading and watching the news these days probably does not feel like an opportunity for contemplation, no matter how active your spiritual life. So I thought I would offer two lessons I've learned as a writer, editor, and podcast host about reading, sharing, and debating the news with an Ignatian lens. First, at the heart of Ignatian spirituality is the mantra, finding God in all things. Some things are easy to find God in, things like a beautiful liturgy, a breathtaking sunset, or a laughing baby. But the job of journalists, much to my dismay, is not telling stories about the grandeur of nature or happy babies most of the time. It's covering subjects like the worldwide refugee crisis or the opioid epidemic or conflicts in places like Syria and Gaza and Venezuela. So what does it mean to find God in places plagued by war, poverty, or disease? In my experience, it has meant being attentive to the suffering of others, realizing that Jesus is closest to those who suffer with him, and looking for ways that the Holy Spirit is operating amid suffering to bring hope, resurrection, and new life. A quick example from my own work. You may have heard the news last week that there is a caravan of Central American migrants making their way through Mexico, some of whom will seek asylum in the United States. In response, President Trump has decided to deploy the National Guard to help secure the border against these asylum seekers. So how do we interpret this story in light of the gospel? Where is God in this story? We know where he is not. God is not in actions or policy driven by fear of the other. God is not in the impulse to reject the stranger or the foreigner or to build walls. Pope Francis, the Jesuit, has told us as much. He said, quote, "A person who thinks only of building walls, wherever it may be, and not building bridges, is not Christian. That this is not the gospel," end quote. But that does not mean that we cannot find God working in this story. Where can we find God? Well, 2 years ago, I had the chance to go to Guatemala and Honduras with Catholic Relief Services, with Robert Christian over there, to report on the root causes of the Central American migration crisis. I met men and women and children who could easily have been a part of that caravan. Some of them might have been, I don't know. These are families who have lived through decades of civil war and today are threatened by gang violence. They come from places where natural resources have been exploited and where 50% of children suffer from malnutrition. And in spite of that, they still have hope for a better future and are willing to risk everything on the dangerous trek north. So once you've seen faces like this and learned their names, learned the names behind the headlines, it becomes difficult to see this caravan as a threatening, undifferentiated mass of people. Instead, you see the widow, the fatherless, the alien, and the poor that God commands us to protect and welcome. So that's how I see finding God things in my work, including the news. It means being attentive to suffering, but also being aware that amid pain and poverty, Jesus is there. He is there wherever individuals are giving of themselves to bring about peace and justice and more abundant life. But maybe you disagree with me about migration. Maybe you think the United States cannot welcome more migrants or refugees, or that we need to devote our country's resources to people here who are suffering. Which brings me to lesson number two from Ignatian spirituality. How do we engage in discussions about the news with those who we disagree with? Here, the practice Ignatian spirituality offers is called the presupposition, which comes from St. Ignatius's spiritual exercises. So in that collection of prayers and meditations, St. Ignatius says, "Let it be presupposed that every good Christian is to be more ready to save his neighbor's proposition than to condemn it. If he cannot save it, let him inquire how he means it. And if he means it badly, let him correct him with charity." So what does that mean? Essentially, giving people the benefit of the doubt. Instead of assuming that someone you disagree with is acting in bad faith or from a position of greed or malice, presume that they, like you, have good intentions. That does not mean there won't be disagreements, but it will make for more fruitful dialogue. Giving someone the benefit of the doubt becomes a lot easier when you realize that the labels we use for ourselves or slap onto other people do not tell us everything we need to know about them, or even the most interesting things. That's why at America, I like to tell stories that challenge assumptions and break us out of the very predictable and unproductive ideological battles that we've pitched in this country. Last year, for example, I interviewed my dad, who's also over here. I like to travel with my posse. So I interviewed my dad, who is a conservative Republican. For some people on the left, that might be all they need to know to dismiss him completely. But my dad and my mom, also here, have opened their home in Virginia to Muslim refugees fleeing Afghanistan. America media produced a video about their experience as host families, and the response we got from it was really incredible. Liberals reached out to me saying we need more people like my dad, meaning liberals thought we needed more good conservative Republicans in this country, something I hadn't heard before. And conservatives reached out to say how refreshing it was to see a story that showed not all Republicans think the same way about refugees. And that was the modest hope of telling this story, not to gloss over real disagreements that Republicans and Democrats may have, but to make it a little bit easier for each side to give people the benefit of the doubt, and, you know, to presume that there is more to them than an ideology or a party label that can be dismissed out of hand. So I know that is easier said than done. It takes practice. It means seeking out ideas that are different than yours and will challenge you, and, you know, looking for the best argument the other side has to offer. And that is what I do with Zach and Olga each week on the show when we talk about the news of the week. When we do not see eye to eye on a topic, we don't assume that the other person is mean-spirited or ignorant. Instead, we see the person in front of us with all his or her emotions and her upbringing and life experiences and how much sleep they've got or when they had their last meal. And then we talk it out in a spirit of charity and hopefully with some good humor. And then we go into the interview section.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for that, Ashley. So as Ashley mentioned, I'm Olga. And Megan mentioned in our interview, we've been doing Jesuitical for over a year. And throughout this year, we've featured some truly amazing guests. We've had Father James Martin, New York Times editor and photographer David Gonzalez, and executive director of networks Sister Simone Campbell. And with every interview, we want to challenge ourselves and also our listeners to kind of think more critically about the world and our own spirituality. But to be quite honest, we didn't always think we were going to include this interview section. When we first decided to start a podcast, months before we even recorded our very first episode, we were experimenting with what the format of the podcast would be. And in true millennial fashion, we thought that the podcast would be the three of us talking, and no one else. We thought, we're cool, we're smart. Of course people are going to want to listen to us for 30 to 40 minutes every week with no one else. But thankfully, we grew out of that very, very quickly. And we realized we wouldn't want to hear each other, so we brought on a guest. And this meant that every week we were going to speak with someone that not only we found interesting, but that we would think would be interesting to fellow young Catholics. So initially, I wanted to be included in this podcast, but again, like a true 20-something, once we settled on the interview section, I realized, oh my God, I was terrified, and I did not want to do this. I thought, oh my God, I'm going to be on this podcast with two of the smartest people that I work with, people who are brilliant. They really are, you know? So instead of thinking about the work that we were doing, I just thought about, I just had all of these negative feelings. I thought, we're going to feature brilliant journalists, artists, actors, whatever, every single week. There's no way that I can amount to anything that they could possibly say. So I kind of wanted to just give up and stick to what I know, which was writing and editing. I wanted to stay in my comfort zone and not talk to anyone, not get to know listeners, whatever. And for a while, I was kind of very unable to see the good in what we were doing, and I could not pull myself out of those negative emotions. And at my lowest and most desolate moment, I thought, would I be exposed as some kind of fake Catholic? Like, I wasn't going to be Catholic enough to be on this podcast. And that fear was really, really holding me back from my own growth, you know? So if I had listened to that voice, I never would have put myself out there on the podcast, let alone have invited listeners like some of you in this crowd right now to get vulnerable with us, you know? But getting to where we are now, getting to where I am now has not been easy, as no spiritual journey is supposed to be. And I eventually realized, thanks to all our listeners and the conversations we have with our guests, etc., that God was really calling all three of us to be here and to do what we do. He was active in my life throughout this process, and he wanted me to contribute a perspective that only I could bring to this podcast. So through weekly conversations, including our spiritual direction with Father Eric Sundrup and ongoing conversations with our producer, Eloise Blandio, I realized that if I truly believed Jesuitical was a ministry, something that God really wanted us to do, then I had to act like it. I couldn't just be negative and complaining every single week, you know? Yeah, I did complain a lot. Maybe my co-host didn't know it, but I did complain a lot privately. So once I accepted that Jesuitical was a ministry and just this really pivotal part of my own faith journey, I began to ask questions like, what could I bring to this podcast? You know, what about my faith and the way that I've lived it since I arrived in America would help bring a much needed voice to this podcast? You know, what does it mean to be a Dominican immigrant Catholic? What does it mean to be a woman of color? And most importantly, what could I myself learn from kind of stepping out of the things that I'm comfortable with and talking to new people? So that eventually finally began to shape the way that I viewed what we were doing at Jesuitical. And through this, I started to think and apply the Magis, which in Latin stands for more or greater. And it is connected to the motto of the Society of Jesus, Ad Majorem Dei Gloriam, which means for the greater glory of God. So the Magis means that we do more for Christ, and through this, we do more for others. This meant asking, how are we going to use this new platform, which terrified me, to help myself and others grow spiritually? How was I going to use the ministry of Jesuitical for the greater glory of God? So the work I was doing on Jesuitical was something that it wasn't just about me, it was about everyone else. So along with my co-host and producer, every week I try to bring guest suggestions and guests that will allow us to introduce our listeners to conversations they might not be familiar with. This has included interviews with people such as Afro-Latina slam poet Elizabeth Acevedo and award-winning journalist Mary C. Curtis. And one of the most interesting conversations for me was when we had political analyst Kirsten Powers, and she has been involved in politics and media since the Clinton years. So we had her on, and we talked about what it means to be a woman in media. We talked about the Me Too movement and how to actively engage with people who disagree with you. And not just people who disagree with you, people who are just trolling you on social media. And that was one of the very first times where I was like, oh, I can't just ignore people who don't agree with me. I have to actually, if again, Jesuitical is a ministry, then you have to want to engage with people. One of the most rewarding parts of the show has been trying to find guests that will also introduce our listeners to experiences that they might not be familiar with. So as part of the ministry we do here, I want to get our listeners thinking about what it means to be Catholics of color. I think often people might, when you conjure an image of what Catholicism looks like, it might ignore a lot of marginalized people. So I want to encourage people to know that they can listen to these stories, that they can step into the space that we are creating for them, and ask questions like, what does it mean to be an ally to your fellow Catholics of color? You know, how are we affected? How are Catholics of color? How are we affected by politics and things in the world differently than you might be? You know, we want to create a space where this kind of dialogue is encouraged. So being a host on Jesuitical has also allowed me to broaden my own understanding of faith and allow me to be more accepting of the experiences of those around me, including those of my co-hosts. So like I mentioned, or I alluded to, I was born in the Dominican Republic. I came to this country in the early 90s, and I've lived in the Bronx my whole life. So whether consciously or unconsciously, all of my friends and the people in my world have been people who look like me, have been fellow people of color. So working with Ashley and Zach has really forced me to step outside of that and realize that not everyone is like the South Bronx, not everyone is like the world that I know. And that's been really, really encouraging because these are two people who challenge me every single week. And I realized that even though that scared me at first, it has really helped me to really live out my faith truly, especially in this day and age where we really need to continuously be challenged. And that's what we get to do every single week, you know? And that's what we want our listeners to do as well. And so we ask you guys, too, to kind of think about the ways in which fear is keeping you from pursuing the Magis and how fear is holding you back in your faith, you know? And on that note, Zach will do some consolations and desolations.
What up, DC?
Okay, so the last part of our show is a segment called Consolations and Desolations, where Ashley, Olga, and I talk about the parts of our week where we could or could not find God. It's our attempt at faith sharing, which can normally be a difficult thing for friends to do with one another, right? It's hard. We're shy and awkward, right? And that all those normal anxieties that come with faith sharing get totally compounded when you're doing it for a bunch of strangers that you can't see and that are on the other end and you, like, right, and it's, yeah, that's true. It's worse when you can't see them. No, I'm having a really good time, Ashley. I wanted to start and just briefly give a definition of what consolations and desolations are. Consolations are experiences of feeling connected with God, while experiencing desolation often involves feeling self-absorbed and cut off from God. They aren't the same as highs and lows, or good feelings or bad feelings, or rose thorn, depending on what small faith-sharing group you've been a part of. I'll say more about this, but the gist of it is that you can feel connected to God, consoled by God, in what many of us would consider an objectively horrible situation. And conversely, we can experience being disconnected from God and totally self-absorbed in experiences and relationships that make us feel good, right? That's not to say that consolation only comes from suffering or that desolation stems from only pleasure. What I've been learning throughout this podcast is that it's key to pay attention to where our hearts are directed in our experiences, good or bad. To offer a few examples from my life and something I've talked about on the podcast, I learned a few months ago that my cousin, who is a Marine and who I thought was semi-permanently stationed in an office outside of Baltimore, I learned he was getting deployed to Iraq. And that's a situation, of course, that filled me with sadness and anxiety and worry. But the real desolation in that was knowing that God was calling me to trust him and bring these anxious feelings to prayer. But I actively resisted those, what I knew God was calling me to, out of my own anger or my own desire for control over the situation. So being able to know where God is calling me and not being able to go there, that's the desolation, right? Not just the worry and the anxiety that comes with that. As for an example of a consolation, a few weeks ago I was going to Mass with my mom and sister, who were visiting me in New York. And we found ourselves needing to go to a Mass in a random parish. We were not close to where I normally go. So we hit up masstimes.org, Whoever made that needs to be up for canonization, honestly. They're like, I don't know who did it, but like, if you're here, shout out to you. So we found the closest 5:30 p.m. Mass. And so we got to this beautiful church that was completely empty. The air was stuffy. The priest and the responses were barely audible. And the people in the pews looked like they were at a funeral for someone they couldn't care less about. I'm sure you've never had an experience like this. And I know for some people, experiences like this in Mass can be really intimate and consoling experiences. They tend to just piss me off. And I'm filled with anger and frustration about what could be a beautiful thing and is just not. And I want to just sort of shake everyone and wake them up. And in the past, I've really let this frustration sort of block off any type of prayer that I could be experiencing in Mass. But not this time. This time, I was sitting there, angry, frustrated, and I was like, I know this is what I'm feeling. I should bring this to God. And I did, and I was able to bring an objectively a frustrating situation, but to talk to God about that, know that He understood that. I didn't have to feel bad about this frustration, this anger. And so that's the consolation. Even though I'm frustrated about my experience of liturgy that week, I can still feel consoled. Page 2. Now, we aren't actually experts in Ignatian spirituality. Sorry, Archdiocese of D.C. It takes a Jesuit 10 to 12 years of formation before they're ordained a priest, and even longer before they take their final vows. It's one of the longest formation periods in the Catholic Church among religious orders. And as much as I would like to say it's because the Church put all the slow learners in one order, I know it's because learning Ignatian spirituality, the discernment of spirits, and figuring out how to guide others through those requires years of training and practice. So what we're doing in our lives and on our show, it's not necessarily a manual of instruction, right? Like we say in our show every week, we aren't Jesuits, but we work with them. But we hope that by listening to us trying to discern where God is present in our relationships, our family struggles, our anxieties, and Netflix binges, our listeners are able to look back at their own lives and detect movements of the Spirit. Now, I should tell you, I haven't always been into the Jesuits. The truth is, maybe you aren't either, and you're just hate listening to this whole thing. In fact, I never met a Jesuit until I showed up for my freshman year at Loyola Chicago. Go Ramblers. In high school, I had a conversion experience in a cheaply carpeted youth room while listening to cheesy Christian rock. And I was completely oblivious to any politics within the Catholic Church. All there was my relationship with Jesus and prayer, sacraments, and my youth group parish. It was mysterious but simple. And my worldview got a bit rocked when I got to Loyola. I found Catholics there representing every political and intellectual position possible in the church's spectrum. When I got there, I made really great friends with some people who were more traditional-leaning, if that means anything, and who were generally skeptical of the Jesuits that ran the school they attended. And so I inherited a lot of preferences and taste and distrust from those friends. Jesuits were, after all, Jesuitical. That was also a time when I viewed different beliefs or ways of having a relationship with God as threats to my own. And I beat myself up over that in the past, but if I can give myself the benefit of the doubt or the presupposition, as Ashley talked about, I think I was still so new in my own faith life and relationship with God that I didn't really want to be changed or challenged. And no one wants the honeymoon phase of a relationship to end while they're in the middle of it, right? I remember my college roommate who went to a Jesuit high school and had an uncle who was a Jesuit on campus say to me once that a moment of consolation for him was in simply playing video games, specifically Super Smash Brothers for the Nintendo 64, with myself and our other roommate. And I thought, that's dumb. Yeah, that's fun, but that's not a moment of prayer. That's not how it works. Prayer happens in the church, in your room with the door closed, your eyes have to be shut, and your focus should be directed above, not trying to smash Luigi in a video game. But now I think I was the one being silly and unimaginative. Looking back, those were and still are great moments of grace for me. When I'm laughing and fully in the moment with the people I'm around, everything starts to sharpen a bit, and I'm aware of how much God is in the space between me and a friend or in the objects around us. I now think I'd be crazy to think that those moments only came inside a church or when my hands were folded and my eyes were shut. And that's consistent with St. Ignatius, founder of the Jesuits, taught too. In the first principle and foundation of the spiritual exercises, aka, listen to this, he wrote, God created human beings to praise, reverence, and serve God. And in doing this, to save their souls. God created all other things on the face of the earth to help fulfill this purpose. This is where the great Jesuit maxim, finding God in all things, comes from. People will often say that the devil is in the details. And I think if we say we seek God in all things, we have to invert that formula, whereas God is in the details, not the devil. We expect our God moments to be overwhelming mystical experiences with like impenetrable or inaccessible depth. Sometimes this happens for some people, but in my experience, the feeling that comes with those type of moments can be really fleeting. And I hope this doesn't sound too banal or wishy-washy. It's easy for me to stand up here and say, go look for where God is in your yoga class, right? But to really invite Jesus into all parts of your life, it can be a painful process. It's not easy to look at the parts of our lives that seem as mundane as a daily drive to work, or as broken as a fraught relationship with a parent, or as guilty of a pleasure as binging The Office for the 15th time, and ask, where is God? Pope Francis, Jesuit he is, knows this. One beautiful passage from his latest apostolic exhortation that was just released this week. It's really good if you haven't read it. Check it out. It's on holiness. He really zones in on this need to look for God in all parts of our lives. He writes, when, in God's presence, we examine our life's journey, no areas can be off limits. In all aspects of life, we can continue to grow and offer something greater to God, even in those areas that we find most difficult. We need, though, to ask the Holy Spirit to liberate us and to expel the fear that makes us ban him from certain parts of our lives. God asks everything of us, yet he also gives everything to us. He does not want to enter our lives to cripple or diminish them, but to bring them to fulfillment. And so I'll conclude with two pieces of practical advice that I've learned throughout making Jesuitical and offering consolations and desolations every week. One, do an examine. The examine is a centuries-old prayer practice popularized by St. Ignatius. In fact, this was the one prayer, in addition to the Mass, that St. Ignatius told the Jesuits that they should never miss. And so Jesuits every day, they're supposed to at least, make this prayer where they review their day, every single part of their day. They start with, they wake up, how was breakfast, how was that other Jesuit that you've been annoyed with, how did he talk to you at breakfast, all throughout the whole day, right? Going over the details and the mundane and the exciting and asking what filled me with anxiety, what filled me with gratitude, what filled me with joy, what are the little moments where my heart, where's my heart pulling me? Because though that God is there and God is acting in those moments. In fact, also in this new apostolic exhortation, Pope Francis said, I ask all Christians, not just the Jesuits, not to omit in dialogue with the Lord a sincere daily examination of conscience. And so that was something, being a good Jesuit educated person, I knew I was supposed to do, but in fact, I never really did it. I knew there's a part in the examine where you're supposed to go over the parts where you feel like you fell short of what God was calling you to do that day. And that always filled me with a lot of anxiety, that I would just dwell on that too much and not be able to notice the good things in my life. And so finally, this Lent, part of our Lenten practice was doing the examine every day. America launched another podcast, with The Examine with Father James Martin, where Father Martin guides the listener through an examine, which is really helpful because it's kind of annoying to like have a prayer card, like pray, be like, oh, what's the next step? Back into praying. And my whole experience with that, where I was afraid that I was going to focus too much on what I was bad at, right? I noticed that there are so many things in our lives that bring us joy that we don't give a second thought to. Father Martin talks about someone who said, like, when he was doing the exam for the first time, you know, I never knew my yesterday was so beautiful. And that was my experience, bar none, doing this. So do the examine, and if you have trouble with it, listen to the new podcast. My second piece of advice is don't do it alone. It's so important when you're trying to find out where your consolations and desolations are, to talk it out, right? There's so much in the telling and the retelling with another person where, you know, there's a lot of times when we're prepping our own consolations and desolations. We go over them every week with Father Eric Sundrup, who's a Jesuit, and we'll just be rambling about, not like Loyola Ramblers, but just talking about, oh, this thing happened and this thing happened and this thing happened and I was really happy and I just, you know, it felt so much love. And then Father Sundrup will be like, okay, but what was your consolation? Where was God, right? And it's like, oh, got to narrow that down. And also to have someone who's trained in this be able to reflect this back to you, ask you sort of probing questions. They might notice patterns that you're not in your own life. And also, it doesn't have to be a Jesuit. You can find someone, if this is something you want in terms of a spiritual director, I highly recommend it. Like your parish priest, they're not too busy. Go ask them. Tell them you want a spiritual director. If they say they're too busy, go to new parish. They might not do it, but they know someone who can. Either that or small faith communities, right? Like find a group of friends like I have who you're able to talk about your own faith life with. That's essential. No one goes it alone. Part of looking for your consolations and desolations and doing the examine is really just about paying attention to your life, right? One of my favorite movies from the past year was Lady Bird. And in that movie, and if you haven't seen it, Lady Bird is a teen, a high schooler in Sacramento who's filled with a lot of angst, not sure what she's doing, having problems with relationships, where she wants to go. And she's talking to Sister Sarah Joan, who runs the school that she goes to, about a college essay that she's writing. And Sister Sarah says, "You write about Sacramento so affectionately and with such care." And Lady Bird says, "I was just describing it." Sister Sarah Joan says, "Well, it comes across as love." Lady Bird says, "I guess I just pay attention." And Sister Sarah Joan says, "Don't you think maybe they're the same thing?" So my hope for you is that you're able to use the exam and use Ignatian spirituality to pay attention and find love in your own life. Thank you. Okay, so we're going to move into Q&A. I'm going to let Ashley take the middle.
Oh, no. Yeah, okay. So if anyone has any questions for us about Ignatian spirituality, about making a podcast, about the Jesuits, let us, you know, just shout it out and we will try to answer.
I remember when Pope Francis became Pope, he gave Mass to the Jesuits and he kind of gave a little scolding. He said that when Jesuits become self-interested, when they become pompous, self-centered, they hurt the mission. And I always think about, like, in my own life, like, how do we who are Jesuit-educated do a better job of not being self-promoting, egotistical, and promoting Jesuit values in a way that is inclusive of the entire church? One other way of putting it, he said, you shouldn't shout Jesuit and whisper Catholic.
All right, so the question was, how are those of us who are Jesuit-educated not be too self-promoting?
Like many Jesuits are.
And as a good public school educated person, I'm going to let this go to Zach and Olga, because I certainly would never self-promote.
I think it's offering, like, the gifts that the Ignatian charism brings, right? Like, the church needs it. And also understanding that it's not the only way of being Catholic. I think that's a tendency in those of us that are Jesuit educated that isn't super healthy. So to be able to, like, offer your own gifts from your own tradition that you come from, if you are Jesuit educated, and also being willing to learn from the other parts of the church, the other charisms of the church that are there for a reason, right? So that's my short answer, I guess.
And I think, adding to what Zach just said, just remembering that it's not just about you. This is an entire community. And I'm very guilty of being very self-centered and very focused on self-promoting. And one of the things that we have the privilege of doing, because we sit every week and we talk these things out, is that you have to check yourself, right? If you say that you are a Christian and you are going to embody these Christian ideals, then that means that you have to humble yourself, even when that's hard, and to think, it's not just about me. It's about my fellow Christian. It's about my fellow Catholic. And you have to think about these things, even when it's difficult. Because it's not easy telling myself that I can be very egotistical. And that's not the point of what Jesuitical is. It's not about how many Twitter followers I have. It's about how many Catholics we can engage with, you know?
Or just get people like Olga and Ashley in your life to check you.
Yeah, we do that a lot.
Who was your most challenging guest?
The question is, who is our most challenging guest?
Don't really want to throw anyone under the bus.
Well, how are we going to define challenging? Like, because I think,
I'll just do it.
Yeah. I'm like, how do we start this?
Last week we interviewed Sarah Silverman, which was challenging for a number of reasons. One is that she is someone with a very large platform who has said some very inflammatory things about not only religion, about abortion, a number of things. She's also someone who I think is going through her own type of conversion experience and in her own way, and also who is willing to engage. I don't know how she agreed to come on our show. Some people were upset with us for giving her a platform, and I'm like, we did not make Sarah Silverman more famous. Right? So it was challenging for all of those things, and also just to, like, you want to present, like, a vision of Catholicism that's inviting and that will extend the conversation later and enter and will result in a relationship. Thinking about that for someone who was really famous was, I would say, challenging.
What's your adverb brainstorming process?
The question was, what is our adverb brainstorming process?
So at the beginning of the show, the script is... Welcome to
Hello,
Jesuitical.
Hello, and welcome to Jesuitical, a podcast from the...
Blank, young...
Shout, someone, anyone, Jackie, come on, give me an adverb. This is the process. I go to my sister.
So we say blank young, blank hip, and blank lay, and we try to think of the adverbs. They might be themed to the episode of...
Unimaginatively hip.
Yeah. Barely lay.
Barely lay.
And ironically hip. I mean...
Yeah.
We'll try to tailor them to the episode if we can. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we'll crowdsource them.
Yeah.
So we'll tweet
Which
out.
Which means we'll tweet out our listeners and have you guys come up with brilliant ones when we can. So thank you for all the ones who have shared.
But it's just a fun little Easter egg.
What's our tagline?
We aren't Jesuits.
We aren't Jesuits, but we work with them.
Oh, yeah.
We also do the podcast over drinks, yes.
Except during Lent.
Yeah.
Whose idea was the podcast?
I like to take credit for it. I came up with the name, and so the kind of origin story is...
Yeah, just go ahead, Ashley. Go.
Yeah. You guys have been talking to me. Right. My moment of self-promotion. So there's a wonderful podcast called Unorthodox. It's a Jewish podcast published by Tablet Magazine, which is kind of like the Jewish version of America Magazine. And I was a big fan of theirs from the beginning, and I was like, there should be a Catholic version of this. 'Cause there are Catholic podcasts, but not ones that we necessarily would want to listen to. So we wanted to create a podcast that we would want to listen to. We were just kind of like talking over lunch one day, and we're like, let's do this.
Yeah, as Olga said, we thought that maybe people would just be interested in only what we had to say, like our bar conversations.
Yeah, no, we often find ourselves in like our happy hour bar, like having like heated conversations about Pope Francis and like wondering, like, what do people think who we are? So we thought other people might be interested in it. Plus, we had these really good, high-quality microphones that were just sitting in the attic of America, and we figured someone should use them.
However, I will say that I forced everyone to be my friend when I started in America.
That's true.
So that helps. I want to encourage people to be friends with their coworkers more. So that's my challenge to you tonight.
I think there was someone over here.
What has been your favorite canonization suggestions that you've gotten from guests?
The question is, what has been our favorite canonization questions that we've gotten? So
the one that jumps out, just because it was so random, was Cleopatra.
Oh, yeah. So a little background. So every time we interview a guest, the last question that we ask them, if you could canonize anyone, living or dead, Catholic or not, fictional or non-fictional, who would it be and why?
And often this catches people off guard, and they're just like, ah! And I always want to jump in and be like, it's okay, you can just canonize your mom. But I'm not supposed to do
that. She has done that, and we have banned her from doing that now.
And people are like, oh, good.
Oh, good, I pick my mom then, yeah.
But I've learned to, like, give them some quiet, like, as awkward as it feels for them to be, like, squirming with this question. Mm-hmm. If you do give them time, they usually come up with someone pretty interesting. So Sarah Silverman canonized Mr. Rogers, which I thought was a great answer.
Cleopatra was good.
She just loved Cleopatra.
That was probably the one that caught me the most off guard. Oh, there was a Disney character.
We have had Disney characters. Bambi? No, Dumbo.
Someone from Dumbo.
Was the mouse?
The mouse. The mouse from Dumbo was up for canonization. A lot of really good ones.
And what's interesting is when we're so used to asking people this question, and we're just like, it's not that difficult. People are so dramatic. Then someone threw it back at us.
Yeah, we had our first live show.
And we were like, oh my God, we should not do this.
And Zach said his mom.
I did pick my mom.
He cheated.
Canonize all the moms, honestly. All right. Anyone else?
Yes. So how is hosting Jesuitical help your spiritual life?
The question is, how is hosting Jesuitical helped our spiritual life or faith life? Let me count the ways. Honestly, one of the things it does, and this is, I tried to bring this out in my talk, is that having just any type of community that you meet with regularly to talk about your own prayer life, this is what the parish is supposed to do, right? You're supposed to go to Mass with the community every week to know people there, be able to talk to them about, like, what's happening spiritually, but also personally and with your professional life. But a lot of times that's not what millennial Catholics do, right? If they go to Mass every week, it's maybe not at the same parish, and so it's really tough to establish a community. Or they're not going at all, or they're going a few times a month. But being able to have that type of regularity where I know every week during prep I have to figure out what my consolation and desolation is. So that, like, literally forces me to pray. Otherwise, I mean, I don't think I'm unique in saying I can go for a while if I'm not reminded to pray all the time, right? So speaking of, I hope something consoling or desolating happens tonight, because I've got to come up with another one for tomorrow.
I think for me, it, like Zach was saying, it's also made me more accountable. I think I've gone to Catholic school my whole life, so it's always been easy to just be like, oh, this is a part of my life. But then after graduating from Fordham, I was like, okay, I'm pretty much done. Like, I'm not interested in this, even though I worked with Jesuits and I work in Catholic media. But being on this podcast with these guys in the past year has actually made me come back to the church. Like, I'm no longer a lapsed Catholic. Or I wouldn't even use the term lapsed Catholic. I would just avoid describing myself. But now it really has brought me back. And, you know, these guys have been a part of it. And it's been great, you know? So, sorry that we keep getting mushy up here. But this is really what it is.
We really do like each other. It's not pretending. Ashley?
So you would think that working for a Catholic organization would in itself improve your faith life. But I've found I fall into the temptation of being like a professional Catholic, where it's like, okay, it's my job to be Catholic. I don't need to pray after work. I've been praying as I worked the entire day.
Ashley's just eating pistachios and editing articles all day. It's not praying.
So because of that temptation to just kind of like be like, all right, I've done Mass. I work for the church 50 hours a week. I don't need to pray. The faith sharing aspect of Jesuitical has forced me to do the examine, to look back on my week, and look to find God, which it's a pretty nice thing to do. I
would
recommend it.
Yeah.
I was really touched by your experience with Catholic and color and that part of your talk. So I was wondering if you talked about that on two levels. One, calling out Catholics of color as like special is odd, right? Because it assumes that like all Catholics of color are like post-colonial Catholics of color, like converted by like colonists. As opposed to like, I'm a Sierra Malabar Catholic, so unless there's like a Lebanese person in this room, my family was Catholic way the hell before anyone else.
Right.
On the other hand too then, because of that colonial influence, there's this dangerous assumption that like, I'm gonna boil it down to like Jesus was white. And that's honestly just due to art and in our own sort of biases. So I was just really touched by that, and I was wondering if you could speak to me, just say more on that.
Okay, yeah. So
the question was...
Olga, go.
I mean, you're right. It's something that I didn't start thinking about Catholics of color as this sort of, for lack of a better word, separate entity until I went to Fordham, started working in Catholic media, where most of my coworkers, most of my peers were white. You know, I had grown up with people of color, so in my mind, Catholicism was always filled with people of color. So it's something that I've had to think of more being in this field. And there are moments where I'm kind of like, you know, I mentioned this during my speech, where I think, am I doing this wrong? Because it doesn't look this way. And then I'm like, no, we didn't just become Catholics. Like, there are people back in the Dominican Republic who have been Catholic forever, you know, despite us being colonized. It's a part of my family. It's a part of people I know. And I think that's something that I just want to challenge, right? This is why I always, even when it's uncomfortable, it's not easy to be in a room with predominantly white Catholics and say, hey, you guys need to talk about race, right? But if we don't, then people are going to think that we are some kind of anomaly, you know? And so that's why, yeah, I hope that kind of gave a deeper perspective. But yeah, that's what I try to do, just talk about it as much as possible.
Okay, I think that's it. Yeah. Thanks, everyone.